From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Once perceived as the realm of losers, loners, and geeks, online dating has gone mainstream. Tens of millions of Americans today are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on internet dating. So is the online matchmaking boom signaling an end to good old-fashioned romance, or a new and improved path to love? Tonight on Point, everybody's doing it, internet dating, and how it's changing American courtship, mating, and marriage. But first, news of more White House-linked Washington insiders' new bridge strategies vying to cash in on the $20 billion the Bush administration is requesting from Congress to rebuild Iraq. Earlier, I spoke with Douglas Gell, national security correspondent for the New York Times. I asked him to describe the founding purpose of New Bridge Strategies.
The purpose is to help American companies take advantage of what the company calls the unprecedented nature of new business opportunities in Iraq.
And how does this company suggest that it will help American companies do that?
By helping American companies learn about the Iraqi market on the one hand and get access to people in the American government on the other.
Doug, I guess the thing that caught your eye about the company is the background or the dossiers of its officers. Can you take us through that, maybe starting with the chairman?
Sure. The chairman of this company is Joe Alba, who was President Bush's campaign manager in 2000 and was his chief of staff when he was governor of Texas. The vice chairman is Ed Rogers, who was an aide to the first President Bush and is a leading Republican lobbyist here in Washington. Some of the other principals are people with close ties to this Bush administration and the earlier one, too, including Lanny Griffith, who was in that White House as well.
So is the suggestion of the company explicit or implicit that it is politically well-connected in such a way that it would help companies land big, fat contracts in Iraq?
Well, that's certainly the implicit connection. If you look at the website, it lists the principals and emphasizes in each case their political pedigrees. And the company itself says that the opportunities evolving in Iraq today are of such an unprecedented nature and scope that no other firm has the necessary skills and the experience to be effective both in Washington, D.C. and on the ground in Iraq. And certainly, while some of the officers have some experience in the Middle East, the main experience of a number of them is politically here in Washington.
You quote the President, John Howland, saying that though Mr. Alba spent most of his career in the political arena, the President Howland says there's a lot of cross-pollination between that world and the one that exists in Iraq today. Douglas Gell, by Washington standards, is the sort of forthrightness of this company appearing to peddle its political connections something unusual, or is this just par for the course?
I think it's par for the course. There's certainly nothing unusual in Washington about people who spend time getting to high positions in government then making money later by helping people make money by dealing with government. So in that sense, it's not unusual. I suppose what is unusual is the sheer amount of money that is available to American companies. The administration wants to spend $20 billion in the next year, and a good bit of that's going to be contracted out to private companies.
And the list of connections goes on. There's a Mr. Griffith, Lanny Griffith, involved. What's his background?
Lanny Griffith was a political operative for President Bush in the 1988 campaign, worked in his White House, went on to the Bush Education Department, and has been a lobbyist here in the firm with Ed Rogers since 1993.
This is not just any lobbying firm, but Barbara Griffith and Rogers.
Barbara Griffith and Rogers, a very well-connected Republican lobbying firm headed by Haley Barbour, who became chairman of the Republican Party and is now running for governor of Mississippi.
Now, Mr. Rogers, the vice chairman of this company that's offering to help American companies land contracts in Iraq, ran into some trouble when he left the Bush senior administration.
That's right. One of the first contracts he accepted after leaving that White House in 1991 was with a former Saudi official who was a primary figure in the investigation into the Bank of Commerce and Credit International. President Bush said publicly then that he thought that was inappropriate, and Mr. Rogers surrendered that contract, which was worth $600,000.
There has been criticism of the big contracts that went out early in the Iraq push, particularly to Halliburton, with Dick Cheney headed before he came back into the Bush administration. But Paul Bremer, the current American official in charge in Iraq, says everything will be done by competitive bid. Does that mean that there's no room for political wheel greasing here?
Oh, I think there's always room for political wheel greasing. Now, that said, I should make clear that Newbridge says it's not seeking any contracts itself, and it says that most of its business will be intended to enter the private sector in Iraq to seek opportunities, for instance, to export food or other products to the Iraqi market. But the company won't rule out serving as a middleman to help companies get a share of government contracts, and it would be hard to believe that that won't be part of their business.
Douglas Jill, thanks for joining us.
Glad to help.
Douglas Jill covers national security for the New York Times. He spoke with us from Washington. A remarkable 40% of American adults today are single. Many of them don't want to be. Americans have always hoped for love's lightning to strike. Now, many are not leaving that lightning strike to chance. They're looking for love, for partnership, for a spouse online and in record numbers. The big internet boom is now in the dating game. After years at the margins, web-based matchmaking services have gone mainstream. They're pulling in hundreds of millions of dollars and bringing together millions of American singles. Sociologists say internet dating is now changing American courtship and promises to change it more as hungry hearts learn to love its checklists and efficiency. But is the line item web profile also changing American romance, American mating? Are you one of the 40 million Americans who reportedly visited an online dating service last month? Is picking a profile to find a mate too close to picking options for a car? Or is it the intelligent, practical way for Americans with busy lives to find companionship? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York City is Anna Mulrine, senior editor for U.S. News and World Report and author of the recent article Love.com. Good evening and welcome, Anna Mulrine.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And joining us from Seattle is Pepper Schwartz, professor of sociology at the University of Washington. Good evening and welcome, Professor Schwartz.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Anna Mulrine, what an interesting article you've got here. Apparently, there are an awful lot of people who are not nearly as in the dark about this as me. They're out there participating in this. You write that 40 million individual, distinct, separate Americans visited online dating sites last month.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that when I was doing the research. I spoke with a couple of the researchers and I said, well, wait a minute. You mean there are 40 million accounts out there? Maybe folks who believe in it have two or three accounts on different sites. And they said, no, it's 40 million people.
What does that say
have to write about it.
It's big. What does it say about who's going online? I mean, 40 million, that spills out, it would seem to me, of any one particular age group, for example. Who's signing up? Who's browsing here?
It is. It just like you said, it runs the spectrum, and it's absolutely the case that even a couple of years ago, I think if you told someone, well, I'm doing this online dating thing, or you heard somebody say it to you, I think you would have said, wow, that's fantastic, for you. But I don't think it's something you might have considered for yourself, and I think a lot of people now are saying, wow, that's good for you, and maybe I'll do it too.
And they clearly are. Give us a sense of how active is this. Do people put something up and then go away and forget about it? Or are people really, really working the web in a serious way toward dating, toward marriage? What's the main use?
I do think some people are pretty methodical about it. I mean, they'll come home in the evening, and I think what draws a lot of people is that they can do it in their very rare off time. I spoke with people who, get off work and hang out for a little bit, and then maybe around 1 in the morning before they go to bed, they'll check their account, and I think they do tend to update a lot because that's the way your profile goes to the top of the list. And with some of these sites that have so many people, you need to pop up on the screen. Otherwise, people might not take the time to scroll down.
So people are working it. They're working it in enormous numbers. Pepper Schwartz, you're the sociologist here, and you've tracked relationships and manner of courtship in the United States a lot. You are also, we should say, an advisor for PerfectMatch.com. So we've got to have our eyes open here for a kind of interest. But what do you see happening? The numbers are so big. Does this suggest a fundamental change in the way Americans are looking to meet and match and mate and marry, all of it?
Oh, I think it's extraordinary change in our culture. I honestly don't think anybody's thought about the enormity of this. about the consequences of breaking down geographic, racial, religious, cultural barriers by the kind of surprise element of picking somebody off from basic statistics and a little personal statement about themselves on the web. I think what happened was that an aching need was there. And that need was the fact that people were getting married later, getting more education, going into the workforce, meeting people later, and then having to hurry up and pair suddenly if, you know, a biological clock started ticking. But also people got divorced. They got divorced at various parts of their life, and they were thrown out of social circles where they would be finding a lot of eligible people. So you had increasing numbers of lonely people not knowing where to go, highly motivated, but having no way to do it, thinking of the bars, I think, appropriately as scary and inappropriate ways for them if they were over 25. And this little business started to grow and grow because people were willing to take the risk initially because they were so isolated. Once it grew to a critical mass, it became a culturally approved way of meeting people, and now it is just into, you know, warp speed in terms of becoming the way to meet people. And when you open up the world to be met, you change who you meet.
But we want to look at that risk. We want to look at that cultural acceptance. But millions of Americans, Pepper Schwartz, have married for many, many years before the web even existed. So why this urgent need that you described now?
Well, I will accept the fact that millions of people have married before the web existed. But they met in high school. They met when they were young. They met in their small towns. The mean age of marriage for college-educated people is in their late 20s, 27, 28. They're not only not meeting their high school and their neighborhood friends, they're not even getting together with their college friends.
But they're clearly getting together. They're clearly meeting them. But you're saying they're not interested in marriage at that age, and by the time they get interested, they no longer have that big swirl of college anymore?
Right. They're meeting them, but they're not ready to settle down. They're not ready to get serious. And by the time they are ready to get serious, and I think quite a few people go to the net looking for a serious person to meet, not frivolous. By the time they're ready, they look to their left and their right, and there's nobody there that they know that's single.
And so they've got to go somewhere. Animal Rhine, do you agree? Has it reached a kind of critical mass? I mean, if you're single in America today and you're not online, if you don't have your profile and your checklist up, are you the odd duck?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I don't think it's gone, you know, quite that far where it's odd if you don't have a profile. But I think, you know, certainly the thinking is, I mean, particularly among the 20-somethings, you look at a site like Match.com, half of their members are under the age of 30. And, you know, they're...
That means half
thinking,
are over the age of 30 as well.
And half are over, absolutely. And I think their thinking is, well, why wouldn't you do this? You know, I mean, a lot of people who kind of... I was actually quite surprised at the number of early to mid 20-somethings who are active in this, because you would think, wow, they're social prime. Yeah, exactly. And
but look how
and
they're
you know, they move to new towns and start a job, and they think, wow, well, I'll just this will be a good way
get
to
get in line
people.
Because that's the way. Pepper Schwartz, I heard you there.
Yeah,
I was just saying that even for the young people, look how much more they can find out about. Look how much better it is than a bar. Or even somebody, you know, fixing you up, you know, at a dinner table where you're there stuck looking at each other and people are expecting you to at least try and like each other.
You're saying it's better because?
It's better because, first of all, you can, first of all, see what somebody looks like most of the time, so you can check out a little bit of chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, you can look at hobbies, background, age, you know, how they feel about kids. You get a lot of information really quickly that you would have to go out on a date first.
Do you get the truth online?
I would have to say my experience both as a professional working for PerfectMatch.com and a couple .coms before that and as a consumer when I was at one point is that I never met anyone who really had lied to me. I'll tell you where people fudge the truth a little bit. They give you a better picture than they actually look like.
Of course, you put your best one up. Yeah.
You know, everybody would put their best one up.
Right.
They tend to overestimate their height or underestimate the weight.
Right.
But I would say real pathological stuffs are rare, really rare.
We've got a lot to talk about tonight. We want to hear from you. We're looking at the Internet dating boom and how the web is changing American courtship, mating, and marriage. Have you gone looking for love online? And is Internet dating a blessing or a curse? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about internet dating, the internet dating boom, and how the web is changing American courtship, mating, and marriage. My guest tonight, Anna Mulrine. She's joining us from New York City. She's senior editor at U.S. News and World Report and author of the recent article there, Love.com. From Seattle, Washington, Pepper Schwartz, professor of sociology at the University of Washington. You can join this conversation, too. How is the web changing the way Americans get together, the way they match up? And is the internet better or worse for meeting and courting than the workplace, the church social, the gym, the bar? Is this a sign of the evolution or devolution of the American relationship? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jamie's calling from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Hi, Jamie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Good evening.
I wanted to call in and let you know that I'm getting married on November 1st to my fiancée, who I met on Yahoo Personals.
Oh, my gosh. So there it is. Boom.
Congrats.
How
Thanks.
Long ago did you meet Jamie?
It was July of last year.
So July 2002.
And we were engaged last Christmas.
So 6 months later, you're engaged. Jamie, tell me exactly how this works. I have to admit, I'm really a neophyte here. I looked at the site for the first time today, but I don't completely get it. You went on, and what happened?
Well, I had a friend from college who had gone on and had a couple of internet
flings, what,
I
dates?
Had put a personal on the internet.
I see, okay.
And had met her partner through online dating.
Right, so she said, try it, Jamie, it works.
Exactly, and she owned her own business. She was a very successful person, very attractive person. And I said, well, if people like that are using it, then those are the kind of people I want to meet.
So you went on and, I guess, tell the truth. You looked at the pictures.
I did. And I think that the technology, the fact that you now have digital photography and digital scanners, which make it very inexpensive for people to make digital photographs, it makes it possible now for people to put pictures online, which
It was more difficult. I was stunned a couple of hours ago when I went on and looked. I mean, there are lots and lots and lots of pictures there. No one's shy about it. They're all up there. But how did you decide, you know, did she come to you or did you make the first move? And how did you decide this is the person, the woman that I'm going to get in touch with?
I made the first move, I would say, over the I really only used the service for 3 or 4 weeks, literally before we met. And I would say during that time, I probably went through 100 or more advertisements or, postings.
You mean that you made contact with or you just checked out, looked at?
I would say of the 100 or so that I looked at, I probably made contact with a dozen or attempted to make contact with a dozen and probably talked with half of those.
So you sent out emails on some kind of blind address. They emailed back, and when you say you talked, they gave you a phone number. You called.
With some, it was just email, and with some that were more interesting, we had a phone call, and with about four of them, I had dates. And the fourth woman that I went out with, getting married to in a month.
Was your fiance nervous about meeting you? How did she know you weren't some kind of, crackpot or, I don't know, dangerous guy?
Well, she actually had a different experience. It's unfortunate she's at work right now, but she had some bad experiences with a few men who had misrepresented themselves. One of them she thought might have actually been married, which he didn't say.
And which we read happens a fair amount, a fair bit online. But okay, she had a bad time, but she came back.
But literally, I guess, days after she had already decided she was going to take her profile down, she got an email from me, which we had some similar interests and some similar experiences, which I was able to pick up on from her profile. And my email intrigued her, and she wrote me back.
Where did you first meet physically?
We went to the Asiana Grill in Arlington for our first date.
In Massachusetts, so you went to a restaurant?
Yes.
And there it was, and here you are about to be married. Well, wow, there's a story of how it works. Jamie, thanks for sharing it with us, and congratulations, good luck, and all that.
Thank you.
Jamie, thanks for calling. Anna Mulrine, to you first. Is this a typical story? Is this how it works?
Oh, I heard story after story. I'd tell people, you know, friends ask, oh, what are you working on now? And I'd tell them I'm working on this particular piece. And they'd say, oh, I have a neighbor, I have a brother, or, you know, a good friend who met their fiance that way or who are married. I think my favorite story, I chatted with a couple and, you know, they were both kind of looking online. One was more reluctant than the other. And then they got to chatting and, you know, they... Finally, he decides he wants to ask her out for dinner, but, you know, he didn't want to be the stalker and ask her where she lived. And so he told her where he lived. And she says, oh, my gosh, you know, if you look out your door, I bet you can see me. We're right across this, you know, courtyard from each other. They were in the same apartment building. They had lived in that same pretty sociable, you know, kind of one story style apartment building for a year and a half.
And yet they had to go on the World Wide Web to meet. Pepper Schwartz.
Absolutely.
Let me put it to you, Pepper. One thing I heard in Jamie's story is a kind of acceleration, maybe. I mean, people do meet and get engaged quickly, but they met for the first time, engaged 4 months later. Does the web somehow accelerate relationships because people come in having read a lot about the other before they even meet?
I think it does in two ways, one of which is there's something about writing, about typing, where people seem to reveal their soul more. They seem to be so much more frank, you know, across that semi-anonymous cyberspace, mm-hmm. that they can get into some fairly soulful, open, very frank, honest discussion with each other. And honesty is always intimacy building, you know? I mean, you put yourself out there, someone either likes it, they don't. The other thing is a lot of the sites, I certainly know Perfect Match does because I created it, have these personality tests or some kind of test where you learn about yourself and you learn about the other person. So you may actually have a profile, an image of that human being, depending on which site you've gone to, that helps you understand who you're meeting and helps them understand you. In other words, you've sort of been doing both research and interaction before you actually meet. Mm. And if there's chemistry there, wow, the connection's pretty fast. Either way, it's either like, yeah, this is something I'm paying attention to, or it's very disappointing because you had so much in place except chemistry.
Anna, I'm looking at your article the last couple of days and listening tonight. You write that sociologists are actually changing the way they research how relationships are built and their durability, their likelihood of success, based on all this data that's pouring in off the web. Are you saying that the relationship building is becoming more scientific because it's got this technology involved?
It's certainly the goal to try to integrate some of that into this process. And, you know, they've just done a great deal of, I mean, they've just been amazed by the response that they've gotten. I mean, I think a lot of researchers are used to having, you know, to just beg and plead to get a dozen college students in a room to, you know, fill out some forms. And now they've got this amazing, you know, feedback community at their disposal. And you know, they.
So they've got all this data, all these profiles, and they can see sooner or later, they kind of see what works and what doesn't work and what are they learning.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can have some, you know, some real life feedback. Did you take the psychology test? Did it give you insight? Does it describe you? Does it describe the people you met? Did it help you select one person from the other? I mean, some, you know, and the biggest problem is not that you can't get a good, huge, diverse population to talk to. However, the scientist in me says we have a problem with it's not being a random sample. And in other words, you don't know if you're selecting out who's talking to you. In other words, mm-hmm. if I ask these questions, I have to be able to compel both people who thought this was a great test and people who didn't in random numbers to tell me what they thought. Otherwise, I'm getting pretty skewed results.
So do I hear, Pepper, that you're skeptical about this being a basis for refining a kind of science of relationship building?
I'm not skeptical about it at all. I just think it takes some real serious talent and some real serious testing to make sure you've got what you think you've got.
But it's clear.
Make sure.
But you can have a lot of checklists out there with a lot of personality profiles and ultimately outcomes, and yet, what about that old-fashioned kind of organic meeting? Rena's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Rena. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Yeah, I've enjoyed listening to your conversation. I've recently been a member of Match.com, and I have to say, overall, I have not had positive experiences with it.
What happened, Rena?
I have had situations where I've communicated with people. I've probably met up with three or four different people, and definitely found that people misrepresented who they were.
In what dimensions? The physically or their personality, their accomplishments?
Physical, personality. I mean, I would say I've had two situations where the people were, I would consider them strange. And, you know, I'd had dialogue on email. You know, you did not pick that up. So, I mean, it was almost like the email was written by somebody different than the person you were meeting.
So this left it not only disappointing, but maybe even a little bit scary for you?
Yeah. One question I have for both of your guest speakers. I am a single woman in my late 30s, and I have not posted a profile. And I'm curious typically what I've done is joined and sought out somebody that I thought I might be compatible with.
But you haven't put your own profile up, so they're not coming to you. You're going to them.
Right. And then what I would do is email a picture. If there was dialogue back and forth and they wanted to see a picture, then I would send a picture. Because obviously, it's fair. I see a picture then, so.
Rena, what's your hesitation about putting your own profile and photograph up?
I guess I'm afraid of, just being bombarded with, and I don't mean to sound egotistical, but, strange emails or, there's still that apprehension about somebody, stalking you.
Yeah. Animal Ryan, what did you find? You heard Rena's experience. She went out. She found men online who looked good, and she didn't have a great hit rate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I spoke with plenty of people who had the same experience and across the board, I mean, women in particular were just really careful about the security stuff. I mean, they used a separate email address, just one set up by the service. It wasn't even their web account.
Right.
And before they called, they did call blocks. I had one woman who always told her landlord, who happened to be a cop, where she was going, and gave him her cell phone number and her date's cell phone number. And,
well, it's a lousy feeling to have to do that when you go out on a date.
Absolutely.
But here we had Rena, and she had men who she's describing as strange. Let's turn right to the source. We've got on the line Trish McDermott. She's vice president at Match.com. She joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Trish McDermott.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. We just had Rena online. I think you heard her comment. She used Match.com. She plunged in with both feet, and she had some rough experience. The men that she met were not presenting themselves truthfully. Pepper Schwartz was saying earlier she found that there typically is a high level of honesty here, but that's not Rena's experience.
Well, it's dating, and, the good and the bad of dating. Some dates work, and there's tremendous chemistry, and you're just blown away by the quality of the person you meet. And others, maybe there just isn't a good fit. You think someone is strange, that might be quirky. Strange to you might not be strange to me. We're the first people to tell you that not every date is going to be the date for you. I think it's why people come to a site like Match, where there's lots of opportunity to go on a lot of dates. I mean, I can tell you last year, 89,000 people left the site and told us the reason they were leaving is they found the person that they were seeking. So it's working for a lot of people. And whether you're dating online or dating in any area of your life, it truly is a game of perseverance. Every date is the wrong date until you get to the right one. So I would encourage her, or really anyone who's feeling frustrated by dating, whether online or anywhere else, to stay in the game, because that is ultimately how you win.
Trish, how do you advise that people make that leap from a digital connection where each player is essentially anonymous to a contact with a telephone and maybe your home phone and to a physical meeting? I mean, if you're doing this the old-fashioned way, you're likely to have friends around, you're looking across the room, you're talking about that other person, you're saying they look friendly or they look weird or they look menacing. Here it's all kind of blind until that moment that you actually meet. What's, is there a recommended way of using this technology?
Yes, and I think as a business, we have an obligation to get people to the matches that are best for them in a manner that is the most secure for them. And certainly that means, like with Rena, she was talking about only doing one-way searching because she did not have her information in a profile posted. To create the capability of doing two-way searching, so you can say, show me someone who's interested in someone just like me and who I will actually be interested in. But beyond that, we now offer video on the site, so you can see a little bit more about someone other than a still picture. There's actually a lot of great information about how somebody talks and smiles and moves through the world that you can glean from a video. And we also offer anonymous voice. So you can, when you exchange emails online, you're anonymous. It's very secure. But now you can transition to telephone dates where we facilitate on the back end. We call both parties and set up the date. And so you can, again, get to know someone in a more spontaneous format. And then decide if you actually want to meet for a cup of coffee. And then after that, we have lots of security rules about how to date securely, right? You meet for coffee, you come in your own car, you never pick someone up at their home or have someone pick you up at your home.
So public places, your own transport, you can get out of there if you don't like it. You can stay if you do like it. How many active users does Match.com have now?
We have 9 million members on the site with profiles posted actively using the site in the last 60 days. So it's a very large community, which is why we are now focusing on having tools to get people to the dates that are right for them, because there actually is such a thing as too many potential dates now thanks to online dating.
And what's your sense of how this will ultimately change American relationship building? Is it like everybody's got their Yenta, their magical matchmaker now? Will it all be done with checklists and, I want someone just like me or someone just not like me? How's it going to change it?
I do think it is already having a fairly significant sociological impact. Most importantly is that it's simply getting people dating again, and that may sound, silly, but dating is a process that we perfect over time. We get better at making choices. We get better at conducting ourselves on dates, knowing who's right for us and who isn't right for us as we practice. So if nothing else, this opportunity to so easily get to potential matches and start exchanging emails with them and ultimately to transition to offline dates makes us better at dating. But beyond that, we were talking a little bit about tools and technology and science now that might get people to matches that are better for them. And a new direction that we're taking as a company and one we're deeply committed to is actually being able to predict the ever-elusive chemistry so that people don't search just based on demographics. I want a tall guy with, blonde hair and blue eyes who went to college, but who actually have the capability to search on what we think are much more meaningful attributes in terms of how people are compatible and ultimately happy in a relationship.
But is that realistic, or is that just kind of a marketing come on? I mean, can you really fill out a checklist and write an essay and somehow get to the magic chemistry of a relationship?
No, you can't. You can't fill out a checklist and write an essay. But we think that you can take our test. It's free to take, and I would encourage anyone to come to the site and take it. Even if you're married, it's incredibly insightful. I took it and learned a lot about myself. But what we think we can do is glean from you in a way that makes it very hard for you to fudge information on a very deep level about how you behave and believe and the quirks in your personality and how those make you either attractive or not attractive.
Well, a lot of people are clearly buying that. Trish McDermott, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Trish McDermott is vice president at Match.com. We're looking at the internet dating boom. You can join the conversation 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the internet dating boom and how the web is changing American courtship, mating, and marriage. What do you think? After the first 30 years of online dating, will we have better or worse marriages? Is there a downside to slicing and dicing your options on the web? Is this the death of romance or a smarter way to go? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Keegan's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Keegan. You're on the air.
Hello. First of all, I'd like to say thanks for having me. I'd like to say that I'm a firm believer in love at first sight because and all of the romanticized, feelings about love. But I think that one of the things that is really good about online dating, and I have tried it, I didn't have any luck, and it was, while it was very intimidating, I think one of the great things is that we've all heard the phrase, love is enough or whatever, and I don't think love is enough in some cases. In a lot of cases, you have to know the day-to-day fundamental how you work with a person to know if you're going to work with them for the long term.
So a lightning strike of attraction isn't enough, but what can you learn online that you won't learn in a conversation, or you won't learn from someone that you work with, or someone that you meet at a social gathering and sit down and talk to? Why does the web help, Keegan?
I think the web helps because it makes all of that easier. Whereas people might have inhibitions about going up to someone and talking to them, going up to someone and saying, hey, let's have dinner, and then how to get through all of that information. When you go on the web, a lot of these lists, a lot of these things answer a lot of questions that you're going to ask anyway.
Such as?
So it's immediately known that, hey, they love soccer, or they would never climb a mountain in their life. And if you're like, I love the outdoors, and I could never sit at a desk for more than 4 hours at a time, you know that there's going to be some fundamental discrepancy there right away.
Yeah, and Keegan, you said you found the internet dating thing very intimidating. Why?
Well, it's daunting, I think, because there's so much information. And while it's really nice to be able to say, hey, this is what I'm looking for, let's look what's out there, it's also very scary to think, what, you know, is what I'm reading true? You know, how much? And also, it seems like someone over email can be 180 degrees different in person. And so what you think you know about them over email, and you may know about them over email,
right,
might completely turn around when you meet them. You might think there's chemistry over email, yet you sit
but
down in front of them and
there.
You're like, there's no way.
Wait, it's not there.
Well, you know,
so it
I,
might help
I,
you sort things out, and it might not. Pepper, is it you?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think what's happened is this is getting refined to help people not be intimidated. Like PerfectMatch.com or JDate.com, or there's quite a few that are like, more centered towards their populations, more boutique-ish, trying to make you feel comfortable, and trying to give you the test. The Match.com test that the vice president of Match talked about is a fun test to take, but it gives you a little bit of insight about yourself, but it doesn't tell you how to match up to someone else.
Are you competing on behalf of your employer here, Pepper Schwartz?
Am I what?
Are you promoting your site over the other sites on the basis of what?
No, I think there's lots of good sites out there. In fact, I would say you would join 3 or 4.
Okay.
And because they're different. They really are different, and they give you different information. What I tried to do on that site for them, because I looked at them all and I saw some of the things I liked and didn't like, was to give a test that would give you insight into your sort of romantic profile, what you needed, what you were like, and who you might be able to pair up with. And the more you can find sites that do that, that give you some sense that you're not just like hurtling yourself into a void, whether it's having a keyword to go in. Some of the sites have keywords.
But let me ask let me ask you on that, Pepper Schwartz. There is, of course, this powerful Western notion, and maybe not only Western, but certainly powerfully Western, of magic, of romance. Now, when you start having a checklist about attributes and likes and dislikes and background and, you know, dimensions and everything else, does this become more like a kind of, you know, the arranged marriage scenario where there's a matchmaker who says, well, you know, she hits on these boxes, but not on these. She's not for you, or he's not for you. I mean, is something strained out of this? Does it become more like a contractual, a search of the classifieds for a new piano?
No, because you're not picking on that. That's giving you enough to say, hey, this person will be interesting to talk to, nice to spend an evening with. There's things they like to mountain climb, like this guy said, okay, you know, this might be someone who I could share hobbies with. But there's always that first meeting. In our society, we don't do it on the list. We do it on the chemistry. Mm. And if the chemistry doesn't take us there, I'll tell you, all of the lists won't make a difference. Let me tell you one interesting story I know from my work. And I used to work at Kiss.com the same before, so I really know a lot of the sites, and I do encourage a number of them. And this was a situation where somebody made a date on the web, and because of all the things they made, and it was for a Sunday night. On Saturday, they happened to be at a party, and that they were at the party, and they were not in a particularly good mood, and they didn't see anyone there they wanted to talk to, and they talked to a few people very quickly, but, you know, didn't
okay.
really focus on anyone, didn't
yep.
like them.
Yep.
The next night, they went to their web date and found that it had been somebody who had been at the party who they hadn't taken a moment's notice of. But because they had all those lists that you're talking about behind, they knew there must be something to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
As they talked, they started to have chemistry.
So that magic person may be right next to you, but you need the World Wide Web to figure it out. Animal Ryan, you quote a clinical psychologist, Neil Clark Warren, saying, what, 43% of married couples are not together within 15 years. And of those who do stay together, 4 in 10 say they're not happy. He estimates that 3/4 of marriages are in trouble the day they got started. Does a web future mean happier marriages or just better informed?
I think it was interesting. Pepper was making some great points about chemistry, and I think that Dr. Warren might argue, well, you know, chemistry can work against you sometimes too. You know, he said at one point that I thought it was pretty funny. He was saying that, you know, if you have this ability to kind of, you know, you see this person, you like the way they look, they can chat at a cocktail party, and they have just a little bit of status, you know, you're halfway to marriage. And, you know, you have to back up a little bit and say, well, you know, what do I really want? I was talking to one person who uses the sites, and she said it was so helpful in the sense that Keegan was saying, too, you know, there's this checklist, all these things you want to know. Do you want to have kids? You know, what would you absolutely refuse to spend money on?
So, you know, going in, you've already read about it.
You know what, going in, and then, you know, as she was saying, well, then I, you know, before I get 5 or 6 dates in and I'd find out, you know, this particular thing about him,
right,
and I'd say, well, normally that might be a deal breaker, but, you know, he is really nice and when we've had 5 or 6 dates, you get attached, you know,
yes,
you kind of give into that chemistry, which, you know, I mean, it makes sense that you would. And so she's saying, well, now I just know these deal breakers right up front, and they are important. And they, you know, do turn out to be a big deal in the end. And she felt like it saved her from a lot of bad relationships.
Yeah. On the other hand, Pepper Schwartz, I wonder if marriages at some level aren't made by effort. And I don't know, if people go online, they see thousands and millions of people there they can kind of just rake through. Does it leave them unwilling to put in the effort to build a relationship? There's always another date to scoop up off the web.
Well, you know, people... going dating and getting to know people is work.
Oh, yeah.
I think, you know, you want effort in marriage. I sometimes think people get married because the work of dating, you know, is more work than the work of marriage. I don't think people, in fact, I think the important thing for these dating sites and for people to think about when they go in is to try and do their homework up front, you know, to, you know, focus in on the people that interest them and spend time getting to know them, and not make a date before they feel that they've got something going with them, or they, you know, it's interesting, because you can burn out.
And do you think,
you know,
this, like, will ultimately make better marriages or not?
You know, I think they will. I honestly, now, I think we're getting another topic. I think a good marriage is a hard thing, and your point about having a lot of options may indeed be a point where people can leave because they know they won't be dreadfully alone if they do leave, and it's one more, you know, part of the thing that people couldn't put in the calculus.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't discount your point at all. But I think the more we have an ability to find people who are not just, as I think the great point was just made, you know, sort of chemistry mismatches, you know, the classic woman who has a bad boy fetish and, you know, goes with the wrong guy, or a man who just falls in love with her big blue eyes, whatever. To the extent that we can put together a fuller, bigger knowledge of people and have more people who we should be with to choose from, as opposed to who we have to choose from because they're the only ones in proximity, I think that's a better beginning.
Animal Ryan, you spent a lot of time looking at this. We've just got a few seconds left, but do you end up agreeing? Do you think it's a better beginning?
Yeah, Tom, you make a great point about, you know, finding someone who's going to put in the effort to keep the relationship going. And I think what I found fascinating about these sites is that they help link you up with the person who might be inclined to go about a relationship the way you are. You know, do you love to hash things out, you
mm-hmm.
know, and have an hour-long discussion and really delve into the issues? Or are you the kind of person who just, you know, likes to let things go, and your partner does too, and you guys are both perfectly happy to
and
do that.
And you may
that.
Know before
it,
you
it
even go
helps
in.
To, it helps to find that person.
Well, there are sure a lot of options out there. It left me utterly amazed. Animal Ryan, thanks for opening the curtain. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Animal Ryan is senior editor at U.S. News & World Report, and Pepper Schwartz, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Pepper Schwartz, professor of sociology at the University of Washington. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, a libertarian experiment in democracy. This is On Point. About 5,000 Americans have been holding an election, but for a state, not a candidate. And the state they choose will be a laboratory for what they call the biggest experiment in democracy since the Revolutionary War. The libertarian members of the Free State Project have agreed to move to the state that wins its special election as soon as membership reaches 20,000. Once there, they hope to transform that state into a new national model for smaller government and individual liberties. The winning state will be announced tomorrow. Elizabeth McKinstry is vice president of the Free State Project. In this radio diary, she explains how an influx of 20,000 can begin to mold a libertarian's utopia.
We anticipate that people will change the culture in a number of ways, the main one being political. 20,000 isn't enough to take over any state, even the smallest one, but it is enough to open up dialogue to third-party candidates to talk about the appropriate role of government in the lives of citizens. But we also think that people will have an impact just in general culture, letters to the editor, joining the Rotary Club, talking to their neighbors, really being examples of what it's like to have responsibility for yourself and take responsibility for the needy in your community without the government doing everything for you. The Free State Project is not unprecedented. There are lots of situations where people have done the very same thing. Vermont is one, San Francisco is another, Utah is a third. In fact, if you look at how this country was founded, it's a similar situation. People who share the same values like to be in the same place. Now, we may be a little more overt and a little more organized about it, but it's a great American tradition, and we're just following in the footsteps of those who've gone before us. In the 1970s, a series of essays were published about how Vermont could become a haven for those in the far left back to the earth movement. And over time, people have moved and done that. And out of that have come sort of the Ben and Jerry's culture, but a lot of that really liberal, progressive political culture. Now, there's a little bit of backlash you see going on in Vermont, but basically it's become a state that was envisioned 20 years ago. That's what we're trying to do, and it definitely has been done before. The 10 states that are under consideration are Alaska, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, Delaware, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. With 20,000 people, you can have a pretty significant impact on any state under about 1.5 million. So that's the main criterion. Other criteria include things like, is there already a culture of liberty? Is there already a spirit of independence there? Things like dependence on the federal government. For every dollar you send to the federal government, how much do you get back? That kind of thing. When people sign up for the project, they're committing on their word of honor, basically, that once we reach the 20,000, they'll move to the chosen state. It's not a legally binding contract. We basically are counting on people to do what they say. Do I think that there'll be a little attrition? Definitely. But I also know that there are plenty of people out there who haven't signed up literally with us, but are intending to move once the state is chosen and the move starts to happen. So I think those two effects will balance each other out. Once we reach 20,000, that's when the clock starts ticking on the 5-year window that the members have to move. We want this to be as practical as possible for members, so they have plenty of time to plan and find a job or a storefront for their business or a house or an apartment. So members have 5 years from the time we reach 20,000 to move to the new state. Although I should say that there are people who are planning to move, you know, October 2nd. They've got their bags packed and are ready to go.
Elizabeth McKinstry is vice president of the Libertarian Free State Project. The project will announce its winning state tomorrow. To learn more about the project and tomorrow's winner, visit our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.